Welcome to LSE Share Talk. This is Peter Higgins and Conker's Corner, and today I have Todd Wedding, CFA. He's speaking with us from Cincinnati in the US of A. Todd will be speaking about his personal views on investing, and anything he shares with us today is not with regards to his company. Todd is an author as well, and we'll be talking about his book later on, covering dividend and compounding of returns. Hello, Todd, and how are you today, mate?
I'm great, Peter. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, sir. As I spoke to you briefly before, I was asking about your 4th of July celebrations.
Yeah, we had plenty of fireworks going on around us, but with an 18-month-old in the house, we weren't able to enjoy them very much. We had to watch them on TV.
Okie dokie. Now, Todd, we've spoken before. We've been following each other on Twitter for a little while now. And I want to obviously cover your book a little later on, which you wrote, Keeping Your Dividend Edge, a fantastic book, which got covering your returns regarding dividends, etc. But first, because obviously we've got a primarily, whilst we've got a global audience, we've got a UK audience who may not be aware of you or your book. So what I want you to do first, if I may, is just ask you, to just cover a little bit about your background, your first interests, etc.
Sure. So it's kind of an interesting story. The way I got into the finance industry was sort of non-traditionally. A lot of people go to university and study finance or business, and for me, I didn't know what a stock was when I graduated college. The reason I got my first job, which was with the Vanguard Group, which I think a lot of your listeners are aware of, was because I was good on the phone. And so when I was at university, I recruited high school students before they came to university. So I would give them a call, talk to them about what it was like to be a student at my university. And so I did that for 4 years. And Vanguard was looking to hire someone to basically be on the phone and answer client questions. And they saw I had a good academic background. I studied history, and I had a minor in economics, but it was really just kind of theory and not anything practical like investing. And so they took a chance on me and gave me all the licenses that I needed. And I was on the phone within 3 months. And so it was kind of a different way to get into the industry. It was very, very bottom level, but I can think of no better company to start your career with than with Vanguard, because it immediately taught me the principles of long-term investing, of keeping your costs down, of common sense, of all of the really good foundational points that you need to be an investor for the long term. And I can think of a lot of different places I could have started that could have been had a lot worse influences on me.
Okay.
And so I had a great, great experience there. I talked with probably in my career, I estimated maybe 30,000 customers.
Wow.
When I was there. So maybe, 40, 50 calls a day.
Right.
And so I got to talk to private investors on a daily basis. Really understand what their interests were, what their concerns were, what they're struggling with. And so what I've always tried to do throughout my career is keep those folks in mind and try to explain everything on a very as simply as I can without using a lot of industry jargon. We tend to do that in the industry a lot, use these big words and confuse people. So I try to keep it as simple as possible. I was with Vanguard for 2 years, and so I worked in mutual fund questions, and I answered brokerage questions for a year. And then, as luck would have it, my wife, fiance at the time, was in Virginia. So I moved closer to her and worked at SunTrust Asset Management in Washington, D.C. It wasn't a very long stay, but it had some great, lessons for me. I worked with a lot of very, very wealthy people, tens of millions of dollars in assets. And some of the things I learned from them were, the benefit, and I mentioned it in the book, is, benefits of, buying great businesses and holding them for the very long term.
Yeah, long term, yeah.
And so, you know, a lot of times you would see their accounts and they would have, you know, Procter & Gamble or some stuff like that with, you know, a dollar cost basis. And so, you know, they had it for 30, 40, 50 years.
Yeah.
You know, the dividends that they were getting on that investment in retirement were just
staggering.
Staggering.
Yeah, yeah.
So I did that for about a year. And then I discovered a company that was right down the street from where I lived called The Motley Fool. And I think a lot of retail investors in the UK know The Motley Fool.
Yes, they do. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I started with The Motley Fool. For me, it was a 180 degree transition from working at a bank.
Of course. Yeah.
We wore shorts to work and flip flops. So for a 25-year-old, that was the greatest job in the world. And so, you know, again, I got to talk to private investors on a regular basis. I got to, you know, use my writing, which I really enjoyed doing. I worked on a newsletter at Motley Fool in the U.S. called Motley Fool Pro, which went, we had $1 million of capital. We went long and short the market. We used ETFs and so on. We had options, which are basically derivatives. And the good thing is we started that in October of 2008. So we had $1 million in cash in October 2008. There were worse times to be blessed with that much cash.
Yeah, because we just had the essential crash, the financial crash, hadn't we, earlier that year, 2007, right. 2008, April. So you were just coming out of that point then, is that correct?
Exactly.
Oh,
so,
wow, okay.
So we still had plenty. We had a couple of months to go before we hit bottom, but you know, it was a very interesting time to be an investor. You know, I think it's hard to explain to some of the younger folks in the industry today what it was like to invest other people's capital and your own through that period, because it really was quite scary at times.
Yeah.
And you know, I think overall we held our nerve very well, and our subscribers were very happy. From then, some of your listeners might know that I went to the UK and worked in London for a year, running a newsletter in the UK on dividend investing, which I wish would have gone on a lot longer than it did. But you know, I think we built some real momentum there and helped some people out. At least I hope so.
Could you tell us a bit more about that, Todd? Because I don't recall that bit.
Sure.
What was it called and who was it with?
So it was with The Motley Fool.
Again,
and,
yeah, okay.
Yeah, so I worked in the London office over in Bloomsbury, and I ran one called Dividend Edge. So
right, okay.
So we had, I think it was 25,000 pounds of capital. So not a large amount, but you know, enough to kind of to associate with maybe the retail investor in the UK a little bit more. And so we allocated that capital over the course of a year. You know, the Motley Fool decided that it wanted to go a different direction with its newsletters, and you know, unfortunately, it kind of stopped me in my tracks and this, you know, and the service in its tracks. And I wish it could have gone a lot longer than it did.
So what year was that, Todd? Sorry,
that was 2011.
2011. Okay.
Yeah. And I hope that the subscribers listening know that I wish them well. They're doing very well, because I do miss conversing with them.
Right. Okay.
And from there, I went to Chicago. I worked for Morningstar.
Okay.
Which is another, you know, kind of global financial brand.
Yeah, I'm aware of that. They're huge, aren't they? Huge brand. Yeah.
They are. They and they've done a really good job. You know, going into the UK and other markets and bringing their brand there. So I worked as an equity analyst there on the sell side. So my research was done for, you know, clients. My research was sold off. And my sector of coverage was paper and packaging, which is about as exciting as it sounds. but there were some very interesting industry dynamics going on at the time. There was consolidation. You know, it's a commodity industry, but you know, it was interesting to see, you know, some of the people in the investing community thinking that this was kind of a, you know, the consolidation was going to lead to some, you know, new paradigm within the industry. And you know, at the end of the day, it's still a commodity producer. So but it was a great experience for me. I was at Morningstar for 3.5 years. I had a great experience there, you know, really getting immersed in their economic moat methodology, which is is derivative of a Warren Buffett line about, you know, building an economic moat in capitalism so you can maintain high profits despite competition. So it was really interesting to kind of to learn how Morningstar thought about it, and I've kept that with me as I've moved forward as an investor. When I was there, I also headed up the stewardship methodology, which takes a look at management teams and how well they allocate capital within their business. So that paired with the moat methodology to me was a huge step in my investing evolution, and I keep it with me today.
Okay, could you expand on that a little bit more for me, for our listeners that don't quite understand that? Because obviously, we always talked about return on capital and return of capital invested, etc. But could you just expand a little bit on that methodology for us, please?
Sure. So basically, what Morningstar tried to do is take a look at why companies might be able to out-earn their cost of capital over the next 10 years and beyond. So, you know, in a perfect capitalism where there are no structural advantages, you would expect that if one company was out-earning its cost of capital, that competition would come in and drive returns down closer to the cost of capital in pretty short order. Yeah. And we've seen that happen with various companies over the years. You know, they have a hit product, but all of a sudden other competitors come in, do it better, do it cheaper.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
And the returns go back to cost of capital or below. But what, you know, the companies that Warren Buffett and investors like that try to look for are these companies that can maintain those high returns over a long period of time, so 10 plus years. And then the question is, what is it structurally, what is it unique about that business that allows them to do that over the long term? And it's not always easy to see. So, you know, some classic examples are like eBay with its auctions, right? So that's network effect. As, you know, new buyers and new sellers come together, the network itself becomes more valuable. Facebook is another example of that. You know, as more people joined, more the network of connections grew and grew and got more valuable. Another one might be just classic brand value. So Coca-Cola, for example. But the question there is, you know, there's a difference between brand and moat brand. So a company that has a brand moat has to be able to charge a higher price for basically the same product.
Yeah.
And soda is a perfect example of that, where Coca-Cola is, you know, selling sugar water just like, you know, everyone else does, but they can charge a markup for it because of Coca-Cola.
Yeah. And similarly with Gillette. Gillette was in one of the Buffett stocks for decades, hasn't it, as well?
That's exactly right. So, yeah. You know, like, what is it that makes that brand have a higher perceived value to the customer? And that's rare because, you know, you think about airlines, for example. I mean, everyone knows the airlines, but you're not going to pay an extra dollar to take, you know, a United over Delta or something like that. So it's, or, you know, it's important to keep those things in mind. And patents, for example, you know, the drug companies have patents, of course, which makes it hard to, you know, replicate while they're under that patent. You can look at, you know, low cost production. So companies that can produce the same good for the same price, but do it at a much lower cost and do that sustainably. You can take a look at, you know, the company that I hold in my personal portfolio is a UK company, is Admiral Group. And I think that, you know, they're a classic example of kind of a low cost insurer. And one of the things I like about Admiral Group, and this is not a buy recommendation, by the way, this is just...
No, that's your personal viewpoint. Right. I understand that, yeah.
In talking about the underlying business. So yeah. I don't have an opinion... Yeah. So I don't have an opinion to say on the valuation right now, but in terms of the business, you know, they kind of live, eat, and breathe low cost. And there's an interesting story when they came to the U.S. With the Elephant brand. What they did was they made all the new employees do push-ups or press-ups, as you might call them.
Yeah.
For every piece of paper they printed out at the copy machine. So, and then that's something that I love is, you know, kind of putting that cost first,
yeah,
mentality. Whereas, you know, in the U.S., a lot of insurers are very high cost. They have commission-based salesmen, and it's just kind of bureaucratic. Whereas with Admiral, it's all internet. You know, they have phone, obviously, but you know, it's very low cost. It's kind of like Geico or Progressive in the U.S. as well, just very, very low cost. So that's an example of a company that I would say has a durable competitive advantage in that sense. I don't think many companies can replicate that from a business standpoint. And then you can look at something like switching costs. So switching costs is another moat source, and you can find that a lot with medical device companies. So you think about surgeons, nurses, very busy medical professionals. You know, if they get used to using a certain device or product, it's going to be very hard to convince them on a price basis alone to use a different type of product. Now the NHS, for example, or, you know, a hospital in the U.S. might, push back on the surgeon and say, hey, you know, you got to use this one. It's cheaper. But it's very hard to get them to switch when they're very accustomed to it, because there is a risk that, you know, if they're not used to using that product, they could hurt somebody, or, you know, and so on.
Yeah. So they've got to constantly innovate, haven't they? So the costs can sometimes increase on their R&D.
Right. Exactly right. Exactly right. So, you know, so those are a couple of different ways that companies can have moats: network effect, brand value, intangible assets, switching costs, low cost production. So those are a couple of things that, as I'm researching a company, I try to look for, try to find at least one of those things, and I hope to be able to identify one of those things before I make an investment.
Okay. So given that you didn't really have a interest in investing and so on and so forth beforehand, and you came into investing almost from a side route, how long have you been investing personally yourself, Todd?
So I think I've been in the industry for 13 years, and been investing just about the same amount of time.
Right. Okay. Did you remember the first stock or fund you initially invested in, your first plunge?
Yeah, I think it must have been a Vanguard fund through the company's 401k plan, which is similar to, you know, like a SIP plan in the UK.
Yeah.
What the first stock I ever bought, I believe, was a company called Maxtor, which was a storage company for, you know, hardware computers.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's one of those things people say, you know, your first stock tells you a lot about how you're going to go forward. And mine, I bought it for $6. I might be making this up, but I think it was about $6.
Yeah.
And I sold it. I was like, well, I'm just going to sell it for $7. I had no idea what I was talking about. And so I was like, well, okay. Yeah, I'll just wait for it to go to $7 or $8 and I'll sell it.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That's exactly what happened. So it was, I thought, well, this is really easy. I'll just keep doing this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, it was something, it was just blind luck.
Okay. Do you remember where it went to eventually, or where it finished off? Peaks, you know, and troughs?
I didn't keep good track of
that. Oh, okay, year. Okay.
But, you know, I think, you know, just memory hardware probably would be my guess, not a great place to be, okay, given that the price is always heading
downwards. Yeah, yeah.
But so I got lucky with that one. Then the next one I bought, incidentally, was another storage company, which I think stuck around a little longer, called SanDisk.
Yes, of course, yeah.
And again, I think it was another like 20%. I sold it. So early on in my career, I was more of a trader. I had yet to be, you know, baptized in a sense into the sort of the Warren Buffett school of investing.
Yes, yeah.
So that didn't come probably until I got to the Motley Fool, where, you know, they had Warren Buffett quotes and Peter Lynch quotes, you know, all over the office.
Yeah, yeah.
And they really encouraged us to learn about that style of investing. And, you know, so I've been a undeniable Buffett fan for the last, you know, 10 years or so. And, and I've gone to the meetings a couple times. And, so I'm very much a subscriber to that philosophy.
Okay. So I'd love to hear a little bit about the Buffett meeting. Cause over here the last 2 years, I think it's been shown live on various channels, the Buffett meetings. And it's something that a lot of the UK audience would love to attend at some point. I'm sure a few probably do. Who are shareholders, but it does look fantastic what he does for the whole day sort of thing.
Yeah, it's really like the closest thing we have to like Lollapalooza and investing, where you have, we have great investors from all over the world and business people from all over the world come together in one place. And, you know, last year and the year before, and Bill Gates is on the board. So he's there every year. And Buffett and Munger, Charlie Munger, of course. But, you know, you see all these guys that you've seen and women, in Barron's and in various newspapers and, you know, read them on, watch them on TV, read them in magazines. And, you know, they're right there next to you at the meeting and at, you know, different conferences. And, so it is neat. It's a great networking opportunity. And you definitely feel a sense of camaraderie in terms of, you know, a certain style of investing that everyone kind of subscribes to.
Well, the great thing I like about Buffett and what he's done also is the fact, as what you said there, is that ordinary private investors and huge institutional funds and multimillionaires and billionaires have subscribed to his methodology and still to this day are saying, I'm following Warren. You know, Warren's doing this, I'm following Warren. And, you know, you can't beat somebody who consistently over many decades has proven that their methodology works. You know, so he's a fantastic man and he's done great things for philanthropic things as well, which is what I admire him for as well. So that's good.
Yeah, I think, you know, with him, I think one of the things I just really appreciate is just his giving back.
Yeah.
You know, it hasn't hurt him in any way.
No.
In terms of making money. You know, people are always like, well, I want to keep this to myself, you know, the way I invest. And I found the more that you give, and it sounds kind of corny, but the more you give, the more you get back in a sense. You know, the more blog posts that I wrote, you know, the more people would contact me, and the more networks I would have. And so it's kind of counterintuitive in that sense. And if your investing process really is that good, you know, it doesn't matter if other people subscribe to it as well, because most people aren't going to be as disciplined.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, people like myself have read Buffett for years and years, but don't come close to matching his performance.
No.
So, you know, it doesn't matter if I know what his secrets are.
Yeah. No, I'm completely in agreement with you there. I'm a big believer in giving and passing it forward and practicing mindfulness because, you know, if you're open and you show kindness to other people, the other person will show kindness to the next person, and so on and so on and so forth.
Absolutely.
And that's what I'm all about. And I just think that there can be too many people within investing and share trading and trading that are harsh and can be volatile and can be brash, and it's just so unnecessary.
Yeah, it's you know, I still look up to a lot of people as well in the industry. And I always admire when they take the time to send me a note. So, you know, you're never really at the top of the heap, you know, there's always someone else you're looking up to and trying to learn from.
Yeah. There is a need for more humility, isn't there? Definitely.
Absolutely.
Now, Todd, as an investor, how would you describe yourself given the fact you started off, you know, in storage sort of stocks and now, sorry, funds, storage stocks, Where is your portfolio situated now? Are you low risk, cautious? You mentioned Buffettology, so you're more long term, I would guess.
Yeah, I'm very long term. At least I try to be. That's the goal. I would say that I've become over the years more of a business focused investor, in the sense that if I try to spend at least 80% of my time understanding the business before I start getting into trying to value the company. I think a mistake that I used to make a lot, I try not to now, and that a lot of investors make is trying to start with valuation and then backing into reasons why you should buy the stock and buy the company for the long term. And it's my philosophy that, you know, over the long term, a business's fundamentals will bear out. So if you can get the business side of things right, and at least from the valuation standpoint, make sure that you're not ridiculously overpaying for the stock, you should be okay long term. That's easier said than done, of course, you know, because a lot of times you research a business, you think, I understand this business, it's bulletproof, there's no way it's going to have trouble, and then next thing you know, 3 years from now, they're struggling. So it continues to be more of an art than science, and there's really no way to guarantee that you've hit. And again, even guys like Buffett or Phil Fisher or any of the legends over the years have made mistakes on the business
side.
But that's And so one of the important lessons I've learned as an investor, I'd say in the last 5 to 7 years, is really appreciating the asymmetric return available to long investors. So, you know, the worst you can do is lose 100% of your money. But the best you can, you know, you can earn theoretically infinite returns,
Of course, yeah.
So, you know, I look back at, you know, some of the mistakes that I've made, and, you know, the ones that really get me aren't the ones where I lost 20%. It's the ones that I either didn't buy into that ran up 500, 600%, or the ones that I sold for 20% profit that continued to run up.
Yeah.
And so on. So I think, you know, that's that goes back to the importance of being a more of a business focused long-term investor. As long as the business keeps firing on all cylinders, after you've bought it, and as long as you know, your thesis stands, and as long as valuation hasn't gotten too out of hand, there's very little reason to sell unless you have a great other idea that you really need the capital for.
Right. Okay. I would agree with most of that. I mean, what concerns me sometimes is when you find a fundamentally sound company, and they've got the products, they've got the moat, they've got everything going for them, and you're thinking, right, I'm going to hold this stock for the next 3 to 5 years, and I'm going to benefit from the dividend yield. I'm going to compound that, and then something happens, and usually for me, it's to do with the management. The management either changes or the loose focus. They don't reinvest enough. I'm not sure what your findings are, but it's usually the management that let the business down sometimes.
No, you're absolutely right. And that's been a situation. And I think that's really hard for private investors, particularly, who typically don't have access to management, to really appreciate. That said, having that separation from management also helps in a way. So it works both ways. I think to be a private investor, I think you have a lot more at your disposal than you think in terms of public information, in terms of, you know, the first thing I look at as an investor in a new company, I look at in the U.S., the proxy statement, which is an outline of, among other things, the way management's compensated, how much stock they own. And just you get a very good sense of what the board and the management team's philosophy is around running the business. You know, for example, go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say, for when you say proxy, I'm just going to explain to our listeners, that's the remuneration package and options and et cetera, and pension schemes for the management team. Sorry, Todd.
Exactly. It's in the annual report in the UK.
Yeah.
And so what I try to understand is, you know, are these guys kind of out there for themselves, or are they really trying to share the wealth and take a real ownership position in the company?
Yeah.
So are they just mercenaries, or are they real owners? And so it's an important distinction for me to make, because a lot of times you'll read through the remuneration package, and, you know, you'll see that they made $10 million last year, even though the company's been struggling for the last 3 years.
Yeah.
They have private cars, they have corporate jets that they use, and you're thinking to yourself, wait a minute, there's something not aligned with shareholder interests here.
Absolutely, yeah.
I get very interested when I see management teams and boards of directors that have set up a very strong ownership mentality for their shareholders, or for themselves and
the shareholders. Yeah,
for shareholders.
Having skin in the game is very important, I think. Yeah,
especially for smaller companies, that's something that you really have to see.
Mm-hmm.
Not just necessarily like a extrinsic, or maybe getting these backwards, but you know, you want to see intrinsic and extrinsic motivation. So you want to see them have plenty of financial reward for doing their job well, but also do they have a sense of purpose beyond that? Like, do they really love this company? Have they been there for, you know, 20, 30 years and, you know, live, eat, and breathe that company?
Yeah.
Because if that's the case, they're not going to want to see the company struggle. You know, they're going to want to find ways when the chips are down, when the economy's down, to make the business go on and not have their eye on the door looking for the next job. And that's not always perfect in terms of your evaluation, but it's something that I try to do every single time I buy stock for my personal portfolio.
No, I think that's very valuable information there, Todd. Thanks for sharing that. There does appear to be, though, sometimes there are, like you say, mercenaries, and they float from one company to the next, and they're there for 2 years or 3 years, and they take the package, they take take the golden handshake, and they take the golden handshake on the way back out as well, and you see them bouncing around as directors in 20 different companies, and you do ask yourself sometimes, how can they focus as a CEO on the company that I'm invested in, you know, and they don't seem to actually be able to spend time at the company when they're involved in 40 other companies. It always amazes me that.
Yeah, and it does make you realize, you know, as you invest longer and longer, you begin to see how few companies really are that good.
Yeah.
I mean, you go through a couple hundred companies a year if you read through them, and maybe five jump out as, wow, this company really has its stuff together.
Yeah.
And really understands what its goals are. Management has the right packages. You know, they have a long growth runway. They're not just sitting there, you know, throwing off cash because they can't grow. So those are some of the things that I try to look at when I invest. And also, you know, beyond the remuneration package, you know, I look at how well management's allocated capital, going back to my old Morningstar.
Yeah.
You know, looking at past acquisitions, you know, what did they pay for them? Did they buy them at a good point in the cycle? Did they over leverage the balance sheet to get the acquisitions? Did they put the company in any danger? How do they execute on an operational basis? Did they, exceed their synergy targets? So those are the things I like to look for as well, because that's also a positive sign for me. If you see, you know, a lot of companies are very acquisitive, or even they buy back a lot of stock, but they really don't have any value principles.
Yeah.
They're making these deals because they have cash. And I did a research report when I was at Morningstar, looking at some of the commodity companies. And one of the things that we found was that when the commodity prices were high and all these commodity companies had a lot of cash, they would go out and make these very bold acquisitions.
Yes, indeed.
Thinking that, you know, this is, you know, the times have changed, that, you know, that the, that, they can just continue to spend,
yeah,
and then that commodity prices will continue to stay high. But, you know, anyone who's, you know, seen commodity prices over time, you know, knows that there is a cycle.
Yes, indeed. Yeah,
go up and down, and the people running these companies aren't not aware of that. They certainly understand that there's a cycle, but there is also a lot of institutional imperative for them to make those moves,
to spend the cash rather than investing for the long term. Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, for companies like that, I like to see, you know, ones with smart capital allocation strategies, and very few companies have it very well spelled out. but, you know, for commodity companies, for example, I look for ones that have very low target dividend payout ratios, because, you know, even in bad times, you'll have a better sense that they'll be able to maintain their dividend when times get rough. That ones that don't, you know, ramp up the dividend too quickly when in the high commodity boom and in the commodity booms. Yeah. And the, one of the things I really like to see is when they have special dividends. So they have a low target dividend, which they raise steadily, and then will pay a large dividend in particularly good years, you know, sort of as a one-off.
Yeah. Okay then, Todd. So looking at your portfolio as a whole, 100%, What would you say is within that as a allocation across larger stocks and sectors? Where do you hold most of your portfolio, investing portfolio?
Most of my portfolio is U.S. based individual stocks.
Yeah.
I would say I think 15% of my portfolio, about that, is in UK listed shares. From my old London days, I have a few shares remaining.
Yeah, okay.
And Admiral is one of those companies, which I mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
I have a few funds, but they kind of do things that I can't do well for myself.
Yeah.
And that's how I think about investing in ETFs and funds, is kind of rounding out things that I don't have a particular skill set in. So for example, I own a fund that I really like that's investing in Asia.
Yeah.
I don't really feel like I have any insights into the Asian markets. So I don't spend a lot of time there. And you know, I found a fund that I think has a similar philosophy to my own that invests over there. So I, okay. that's what, that's how I think about that. And then, you know, with ETFs, you know, if there's something that I don't particularly know very well, I'll buy an ETF if I feel like there's, you know, upside in that market.
Okay. I mean, I think you may have covered this already when you answered one of the previous questions, is what are your essential criteria when researching companies? You mentioned the moat before, you mentioned the dividend, you mentioned a good structure and management. Is there any other thing that pushes you over the button?
Yeah, I think, you know, a solid balance sheet is really important to me. And a good balance sheet over time as well. So, you know, I like to see companies that have consistently made it a point to treat all of its stakeholders very well, not just shareholders, but creditors, as well as their employees and their customers and their suppliers. And I feel like if you get all those things, you have a sort of virtuous cycle.
Yeah.
I think where you run into trouble sometimes is when one of those stakeholders is suffering for someone else. So whether it's the employees being paid too little, or the suppliers getting squeezed, or, you know, something happening where the cycle is broken.
Yeah.
You know, those situations I try to avoid. I want to find, you know, if I talk to anyone who is associated with that company, I would love to hear positive news coming from them. That's how I think about it.
No, that makes perfect sense. Cause at some point that chain's going to break, isn't it? And you see all the headlines in the news about people saying, you know, they want better pay at McDonald's, or, you know, Target are underpaying their staff and things like that. So it doesn't bode well for public PR, does it?
No, it doesn't. And one of the last things I would say is, and I just wrote an article for Investors Chronicle 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
It got buried in the Brexit news.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
Yeah. It was sort of tough timing, but, if you're a subscriber, maybe take a look, but, it was talking about corporate culture and how investors can implement corporate culture analysis as part of their research process. And I think this is becoming more important, especially as we have sort of these lower capital intensive businesses like Facebook's and Google's of the world, trying to understand, you know, what is it that motivates the everyday employee to stay there for a long time, to really buy into the business, to, you know, again, when things are not going well, you know, band together and perform strongly. I mean, I've worked at companies that have had that culture, and I've worked at companies that haven't.
Yeah.
And I've seen the difference firsthand. And I know that a strong corporate culture really can have an impact on long-term returns. So that's one of the things I try to do when I research as well. And a couple ways to do that. A lot of companies, if they really have a great corporate culture, will talk about it on their own websites. You'll also typically see, newspapers, especially local newspapers, writing about these companies, cause they have, you know, they're an exceptional place to work, you know, so they attract interest from local journalists.
Yeah.
You can also look at Glassdoor, which is a site for employee reviews, anonymous employee reviews. And some of them you have to take with a grain of salt, because sometimes it's just, you know, a jilted employee who's, you know, fighting their old employer. But every so often as you read a review, you can see little, common themes saying, you know, talking about how they really treat their employees well. We have a great management program, development program, and so those are type of things I like to see, because, you know, that tells me that they're looking at their employees at all levels and saying, we want to retain the top talent, we want to keep them moving up the track and with the company. Go ahead.
No, that's very good, because we over here, you, when you're in London, you've seen the top 100 companies to work for list that comes out every year. And there's quite a lot of companies that regularly on that sort of top 10, top 100 of companies to work for. And that's quite good feedback to see companies up there that are listed as well.
Yeah. And I think it's just one piece of the pie.
Yeah.
Because, you know, what's funny story is I was doing my research for the article. I found that Enron was a top place to work for 2 years prior to the blow up. So, so it's very important to make sure that that's just a component of it. And not say, well, I'm just going to buy the top 10 employers and call it a day. But to make sure that they also have other, those other components I mentioned earlier, like a moat, good management team, so on. And as the case with Enron, if you really don't understand what the business does, stay well away.
What I'll do, Todd, is I'll try and speak with Ian Smith at Investors Chronicle about finding your article, and if it is at all possible, I'll see if there's a way that we can actually put a link to it, so that other people that didn't get the opportunity to see it when Brexit happened will be able to see it. But I can't guarantee that, but I'll have a conversation with him about it.
Yeah, sure, that's fine. Thanks.
Okay. Now, I'd like to touch on something here. I'm concerned we haven't spoken about your book yet, so I'm going to ask one more question, and we're going to talk about the book. What has been your wisest investment decision to date, and what has also been your greatest lesson you've attained since you started investing?
Ah, geez. so probably the best investment decision I ever made was when I was at the Motley Fool, working for the Motley Fool Pro newsletter. It was early March 2009, right near the bottom of the market. And we were short the S&P 600, which is it was a small cap index in the US. And, you know, it just seemed like everything was pessimistic. You turn on the TV, open the newspaper, everything was pessimistic. And I just thought, you know, the position had done very well for us. And we thought, and I thought to myself, well, you know, this is just, I don't know how much better it can get for us, you know, on the downside. And we closed the position probably 2 or 3 days before the bottom of the market. That's not necessarily the best return I ever had as an investor, but, that was probably the first time in my career where I thought, you know, maybe, just maybe, I had the temperament to do this job for my career. Because I think that's, you have to have that as an investor. You know, if you find yourself jumping around with the markets and agreeing with consensus, you're not going to have a very great career. Not that's, you know, the only thing you need. You definitely need the skill set, so on. And I hope that bears true for me. But, you know, that was a trade that I made that I thought, you know, maybe I had the right temperament for this. You know, to be fair, there've been other times where I've questioned that.
But, of course, but, that's part of the journey, isn't it?
Exactly. But, that's one. Probably the greatest investment lesson that I've learned took a long time to learn. I thought I might have touched on it before, and it's just, you know, buy great companies, pay a fair price for them, and be patient. I think a lot of times we get ourselves in trouble by tinkering too much in our portfolios. And, you know, one of the things I've done in my own portfolio, and I recommend this to other people, is to build a sold portfolio. So look at all of the stocks that you've ever sold and then buy them in a fake portfolio, you know, track it on Google Finance or whatever. And you can benchmark it against, you know, the FTSE or whatever your index you'd like to use. And, you know, over time, I've been running mine for 5 or 6 years now, you start to see whether or not you're a really good seller. And so you start to look at lessons, you know, where did I mess up there? Where did I mess up there? What did I miss there? And, you know, so you start to see kind of, that most of the time, at least for me, most of the time, you know, I probably made a not so great process for my selling decision. So there have been a few that I got out just in the nick of time. Things got worse. But there have other times where, you know, I might have sold for an emotional reason, or going back to the counterpoints to my temperament. So it's important to be aware of that as you make future investments, to say, okay, am I buying or selling stock for an emotional reason? Is it purely rational? Is it economic? And write those points down. So as you go back, you can see what your thought process was.
Yeah, I think it's important these days for students of investing and trading to always keep a diary. you know, and the reasons why they've purchased that stock, the reason they like the stock, and keep a diary of the reasons that idea continues to work and the reasons why it no longer continues to work, and then when to exit, to plan ahead of it.
Absolutely. And having a checklist helps a lot too. You know, as you go through this old portfolio and your old diary notes, you can see, you know, your common mistakes. And so put that down as a checklist point. You know, am I buying this stock because this is one of mine? Am I buying this because other investors that I admire own it?
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
I mean, go ahead.
Now, Todd, I want you to touch on your book because I'm saying we've had you on here for a little while now, and you have not spoken about the book. Now, you've written this wonderful book called Keeping Your Dividend Edge: Strategies for Growing and Protecting Your Dividends. Now, that book is a fantastic book, and I've had the pleasure of reading several chapters of it. I can't admit to have finished it yet because I'm a bit of a book buff, and I tend to have loads of books on the go all the while. And I touched on it more recently when I was looking at dividends for some house building companies that got absolutely smashed after the Brexit. Mm-hmm. So I did use your book as a reason why I should buy certain stocks last week and this week. So I just wanted you to speak about the book and just cover a couple of aspects on the book to help other people understand really the importance of dividends and compounding of dividends.
Sure. So really the motivation, the reason I got into dividend investing myself was going back to those investors I spoke with or I worked with earlier in my career that had bought great companies and held them, and now they're reaping the rewards of their patience in retirement. Basically funding their retirements through the dividends they're receiving from their investments. That's hard to do. I should say, you know, I'm sure there are plenty of times, over those 30, 40, 50 year periods where those investors decided, you know, maybe I should sell this and decide not to. So that's always tricky. So, so the point of the book was to sort of promote patience, to think about things for much longer term than maybe you think about investing now. But it really, so that's how I got into dividend investing. Why I wrote the book was because I felt like some of the dividend, sort of rules of thumb and some of the, historical sort of anecdotes about dividend investing, were less applicable today than they were in the past. And two of the reasons for that are, one, you now have a very large and increasingly important alternative to dividends for returning shareholder cash in stock buybacks. Whereas before, you know, 20, 30 years ago, most companies were returning most of their cash through dividends. Now, a lot of companies, you're seeing 50-50, maybe even a little bit more to buybacks. So trying to understand how those two interrelate is very important, and I talk about that in the book. I also talk a little bit about the importance of having a moat in management later in the book. The second major point, and going back to the moat in management, is that I found that, you know, like the people who I worked with who bought, you know, Procter & Gamble 50 years ago, you know, it's hard to say it was easier to do that back then, but I think the competitive nature of today's markets are such that you really need to understand a company's competitive dynamics and stay on top of those competitive dynamics over your holding period. Whereas in the past, you might have been able to get away with buying a company like that and just socking it away for 30 years and not really worrying about it. You know, every company now has new competitive threats. And so whether it's the obvious ones are, you know, the brick and mortar retailers, that Amazon and other online platforms have really, gone after. But you can, any company that can be turned into a software app, should probably be under close scrutiny. So that's kind of goes back to what I was going after in the book was, you know, keeping your dividend edge. You know, dividends are great. I go over all the benefits of why dividend investing works and will continue to work, despite these things. But as you invest, you have to keep these things in mind. Otherwise, it could be very, very challenging for you, in my opinion, over the next 30, 40, 50 years.
I mean, that's absolutely spot on. I mean, we've got companies such as Purple Bricks and Rightmove that have basically, on the verge of taking over the buying and selling of houses, where you used to always go into an estate agent or a bank to do that. So that is happening. But what I wanted to ask you was, given the fact that we're in a low interest environment, or a ZERP environment at the moment, isn't it more important that we should be chasing or finding and selecting dividend paying stocks? You know, given the yields on anything other savings are 0.1% or 0.5%.
Yes, I would say that, yes, but I would also say that also makes valuations more important as well, because you know, everyone is looking for those secure 3% yields.
Yes, indeed.
So I think you have to be more cautious about, you know, what you're paying for high yielding stocks in the current environment. So you have to be even more strict than you might have been in the past. You know, if there's a stock out there yielding 5 or 6% right now, you really have to know why that's the case. And you know, if there's a catch, or if that's due to their dividend policy or their growth perspective, or you know, what is it like? What, because you would expect that most companies would push more towards the average, push down towards the 2 to 3% that you're seeing on the market. So why is it that a stock's yielding 6%? And that's a point I touch on in the book, is if a yield's too good to be true, it probably is. So you really want to know why that's the case. So I think, you know, all else equal, with a lot of people looking for high yield, you know, if you are a long-term investor, if you're a young person, have 30, 40, 50 years, and you think that the high yielding stocks have, you know, high valuations right now, you know, look maybe to where, you know, the stocks that have very low yields, or, you know, have more growth prospects that, you know, 10, 20, 30 years down the road could be the next high yielders. I think it all depends on your time frame. Like if you want the income now, over the next 10 years or so, you know, the high yield is probably, you know, you might have to look at those. But if you do, just pay close attention to the valuation.
Okay. The other thing you touched on as well was that you didn't really, well, you preferred companies that weren't on investors' radar. So smaller companies, you know, with a nice niche, and, you know, some of them family owned as well. Where they've got a lot of interest in there, but they're not the companies that everyone's talking about, the story stocks as such.
Right. Yeah. I think it's important to try to find out, have a differentiated opinion than the market. I think that's the way you're going to generate X returns over the long term, is having differentiated opinions. Yeah. And so one way to do that is to look where other investors aren't looking at, or maybe can't, because of institutional rules. Maybe they can't invest in this type of company or that type of company. So you know, you can find opportunities in smaller companies, I find.
Excuse me.
But sure, with smaller companies, you just really have to be patient, and you really, really have to understand, you know, it's almost like, you know, the things I talked about earlier, magnified. I mean, you really have to understand the moat. You really have to understand management, and the balance sheet strength. And you know, in a lot of ways, it's easier to do that with a small company, because as a private investor, you have a better chance of even getting the company on the phone than you would if you try to call, you know, a GlaxoSmithKline or something. You'd have a much better chance, you know, calling a much smaller company and being able to talk to investor relations for 10 minutes to have your questions answered. And I think that's maybe where a small investor has an advantage, is, you know, their ability to, you know, spend time on smaller companies, where, you know, large institutions can't buy a big chunk of the business, otherwise they're going to buy the business outright.
Of course.
So it's just important to, but before you start buying small cap companies, really feel like you understand the business, because, you know, in tough times, they can get knocked around quite a bit.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, that's a point that's been reiterated a few times, actually, about knowing the business, and also looking in. I mean, a guy that I spoke to a couple of weeks ago, Mark Bentley, and also Leon Boros, actually, touched on the fact, looking in these CEOs and CFOs, looking into their eyes, you know, go to the AGMs, speak to them, you know, and Lady Annabel Brody Smith at AIC mentioned the fact of that she covers funds is to go to the AGM, speak to the shareholders and stakeholders, and that gives you a better grasp of what a company's up to or a fund manager's up to as well.
Yeah, and one of the tests I have for myself is I ask, would I trust this CEO to watch my dog for the weekend?
Sorry, and, that's great.
Yeah, and so it's what, like, if I feel like there's something about them that I don't trust, you know, this is the principle that, you know, I really believe in, is that you can't do a good deal with a bad person.
Right.
And not to say that they're bad people, but you know, if you have any sense of like untrustworthiness or something like that, that you wouldn't trust something precious to you being in their possession for 24 hours or something, you probably shouldn't be buying their company.
That's a great analogy. I'm going to make sure I put that down somewhere. I remember that one. Thank you. Right. Now, in the book, obviously, you touch on investing in leadership. But one of the things that I wanted to speak to you as well about was choosing companies also in boring industries. Now, you've done some research probably on that. I just want you to touch on that a little bit more, that to get an understanding for our listeners of what boring companies and boring industries mean.
Well, just something that, you know, maybe like we were talking about with paper and packaging earlier, you know, something that just doesn't, it's not sexy at all. There's just nothing really, you know, you're not going to be talking about it at a cocktail party with friends. You know, if you tell them that you own, you know, a company that deals in waste management or something, it's just really not, it's so interesting.
Yes, get that now.
Yeah, so I think, you know, you think about the water cooler stocks, you know, the really popular ones that, you know, are on the cover of all the magazines, you know, those are the ones that, you know, they might have the wrong investor base, or they might, you know, be, you know, have a lot of attention from analysts, because if you have 30, 40, 50 analysts covering a stock, unless you think you have some real insight, you know, you're probably not going to know much more than what the market already knows. So I think with some of the boring companies out there, you can find little niches where, you know, maybe two analysts are covering the stock. And, you know, people don't want to buy it because it does something that, you know, that you wouldn't want to do or whatever it might be.
Yeah. No, I get that. I mean, it's a great thing about covering and researching undervalued stocks or under-researched stocks, because when the analysts finally do, when it does finally come on analyst radar, then you get an additional boost from that new coverage, a new set of investors that are buying into the stock.
Absolutely, and it's funny. Sometimes I'll ask these companies, you know, when was the last time an analyst came to visit your headquarters? And I always love to hear, you know, a year, 2 years ago. Yeah, I mean, so. You know, there's just, you know, this gap of knowledge, and, you know, and if everything adds up, those can be great opportunities.
No, I would agree with that. Now, Todd, is there anything else you wanted to share with regards to your book? Obviously, it's on Amazon, and investors can get hold of it. I'll be putting a link on the website once we publish this Conquest Corner for you as well.
Well, I just hope everyone enjoys it. I try to keep it slim and digestible. As you said before, and I'm the same way, we have a lot of books to read, so I want it to be brief and be hopefully brilliant, and
it is a good book to
go out quickly, because to move on to the next thing, and you know, for everyone, because I know everyone's busy, and I also want to try to make it applicable, so I wanted people to be able to read it and use it right away. You know, and inspire something, whether it's to use checklists or to look at the moat or avoid certain situations. So hopefully that comes through.
No, it does come through. And the great thing about the way that you've written it as well is that obviously it's a style of dividend investing, which, you know, is global. So it's not necessarily about US stocks. It's about stocks, whether you're based in the UK or based in Canada or America or in Germany. So it's really good that it does that.
Yeah. So I try to do.
Yeah. No, you did. And you did it very well. Thank you, mate. So, right. I've got two more questions, in fact. If there was one thing you could change regarding the investing landscape, what would it be?
I would hope people would just be more patient and think about investing from a business perspective. I know, I'm sure you talk to a lot of traders, and I'm sure they have a great strategy. But for me, I think that for most investors, would benefit by being more business focused and longer term. Just because I think that's what an individual investor who has a non-finance job during the week can probably do a lot better.
Okay. That's a great answer. Actually, I like that. If you were starting out today in investing, what would you do that you'd not considered or were unable to do back in the early 2000s?
Well, I think, you know, if I could go back and teach myself a lesson that I have now, you know, part of it would be, it's kind of hard because it's all evolution, right? But again, I would say it would probably be to spend more time learning about the business than trying to understand ways where I can make a quick profit by trading the stock, because I think not only do I think that's a healthier long-term investing approach, but I also think, you know, there's so much to learn in investing. And that's one of the reasons I love this industry so much, is because it's like having a liberal arts business. So, I mean, you can take, I mean, I read very widely. I try to learn, try to incorporate things that I've learned from all these different disciplines and apply it to my investing on a regular basis. And you can do that. And there's not many jobs out there where, you know, you can read history or then you can go read biology and incorporate it into your job on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And, so I would tell myself as a 22-year-old, you know, just to learn the joy of investing, the art of investing, and then learn the science along the way, I guess how I'd put it.
No, that's good. I mean, that's the beauty of the industry as well, isn't it? That everyone's learning, even Warren Buffett. Buffett is still learning, and that's the humility of it. Is that if you go into the investing or trading thinking you know it all, you'll come out the other end very swiftly and be broke. You know, so it needs a lot of you know, leave your ego at the door, as they say. Now I've got one last question for you, and this is just something I thought of when I was speaking with you, given the fact you've written such a brilliant book. What is the best kept secret to investing?
I would say that I'm not sure how much of a secret it is, but I would say that I have a couple different answers that I might give here, but
you can give two.
Well, I'd say one of the secrets is to spend time thinking about your emotions. You know, I think there are three ways that you can make money as an investor. And one is information, and have an information advantage, which is illegal, in most places. So all the information out there is widely available, publicly. The second is to have an analytical edge, to be able to outthink other investors in terms of putting all the pieces together and seeing them as something different. Which I think is also becoming more difficult to do, given the intense competition out there. And a little sidebar, when I took the CFA exam, I took it in Chicago, and I remember looking out across this huge convention center, you know, more than 1,000 people taking this test just that one day. And just seeing my competition and realizing that's just one testing center across the globe. Really hit home to me in terms of how many really smart, motivated people there are out there trying to do the same thing as me. And that is very humbling. And so, you know, I try to have an analytical edge and put the pieces together differently, but I also try to keep in the back of my mind that, you know, I might be missing something here. The third advantage opportunity is in behavioral. So I think that's where there's opportunity, longer term, is, you know, if you can control your emotions, when everyone else is losing theirs, to do the whole Rudyard Kipling thing, you know, you'll have a great opportunity in the market. So, you know, if you held your nerve, a couple of weeks ago with Brexit, you know, at least in the short term, it's looking pretty good. So I think, you know, when you have forced seller situations, those are the times that you want to be on the other side of that trade. Not to say that, you know, buying at Brexit was, you know, the best long-term opportunity ever, but because the markets, you know, they're back to kind of where they were before, at least at this point. But you know, I think when you have situations like that, and that's what the financial crisis taught me as well, is when you have forced sellers who are, where people are bailing out because they need the cash or need the capital, if you're on the other side of that trade, that you can make up for a lot of valuation mistakes that way.
Yes, indeed. It's always looking out for anomalies and companies that are seriously undervalued. I wanted to touch on what you just said earlier about the benefit of second level thinking and thinking beyond convention and consensus. There was a brilliant article written, I think it was last September, by possibly your ex-colleague, Merin Somerset Webb at Money Week. And she wrote about how to beat the market using several level thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know.
Sorry, not ex-colleague, ex-competitor, yeah. Sorry.
Oh, sure.
Sorry,
sure,
across the Motley Fool for Money Week. Sorry, that's what I meant.
Yeah, I know of Marin, and I respect her work. I agree with that. I think, you know, you always have to ask yourself, what do I know that the market doesn't know?
Yeah.
Because again, going back to the analytical side of things, you know, it's very hard, especially in large companies, to have an edge on anyone in terms of the analytical side of things. The market is efficient a lot of the time. And so the situations where it isn't is when you have these huge behavioral swings. So, this either just pure desperation or, you know, jubilation on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the times when things can get disjoint. But, you know, most of the time, the market is very efficient in its pricing.
Yeah.
Information is priced in. Analytics are priced in.
Yeah.
So it's your job as an investor to, spend a lot of time on the behavioral side and understand, you know, be ready to buy when others are selling.
Indeed. I mean, I class myself as a contrarian. So a lot of the times when I'm purchasing stocks, I get a lot of questions posed to me either directly on Twitter or via DMs like, why have you gone and bought that now? You know, and I'm trying to buy something which I believe is intrinsically below the value that it should be at. And I very rarely buy when the markets are going up. I usually buy when the markets are coming down, because I'm trying to buy something which I think is someone else is underestimating its true value, its net value. Mm-hmm. That can be painful sometimes, because obviously, as you know, when a knife is falling, it very rarely stops, you know, until it's hit rock bottom. So it is a bit of a difficulty, but yeah, you've got to second level think everything. And I think the more people are saying, oh, this is the best stocks in sliced bread, is usually when I'm walking away in the opposite direction. And I get a feeling that's something that you do as well, Todd.
Right. It goes both ways. On the downside and the upside, you know, you always have to ask yourself, you know, why are other investors buying here? What do I think they know, that I don't know already? And do I agree with that or not?
Yeah.
So I think that's one strategy to have. And I think that's, you know, over time, if you're good at that, the results will be fine.
Okay. Todd, I've covered all the questions. I'm concerned I've had you on here for a little while now. I just wanted to say thank you ever so much for coming on, Conker's Corner. As with all of the interviews that we've had, so far, it just adds to the mix. To have somebody as well as yourself with such vast experience and also speaking from across the water. I wanted to ask you one question, which is not something I've spoken to you about in previously. Is just your view on obviously the result of the EU ref and your opinion of what lies in store for the UK going forward, if I may.
Wow.
It's a big question. It's a big ask, I know.
Yeah, it's a big ask. But it's fine. I would say that, at least from a historical perspective, you know, I would be inclined to, you know, try to understand what the potential ramifications are and what the probabilities of those occurring are.
Yeah.
And, you know, from a long-term perspective, you know, a lot of investors that I admire have said, you know, we're not paying any attention to Brexit, and you know, we're thinking beyond it. And I think there's value there. But I also think, you know, for the average investor, you know, it can be difficult to do that and hold that line when there's potential volatility ahead. So
yeah.
I would say just make sure that, you know, if you're a committed long-term investor, kind of walk through it in your mind ahead of time. You know, if things fall apart, you know, what am I going to do? Have a plan.
Yep.
Now personally, I don't think things are going to fall apart. But you know, I think if you are concerned about that, you know, make sure that you have a plan, so that you're not doing what everybody else is doing, on the way down. So, you know, whether it's, you know, just to say, okay, well, I'm going to add more cash to my ISA, or I'm going to do something to take a positive action in a negative scenario.
Yeah.
So I think that's how I would think about it in terms of how things are going to work out. I don't have great insight on it. You know, I've been monitoring it, obviously, trying to understand what ramifications might be. I'd be inclined to press on through it as an investor. And that's my take.
Okay. No, I appreciate your candor with that. And I appreciate it was a difficult question that I hadn't given you any sort of insight that I was going to ask either. So that's very, very kind of you. Now, Todd, I've concluded all my questions. Is there anything else that you'd love to share regarding your learning to our global audience at LSE Share Talk?
Well, I think it's always a pleasure to speak with the UK audience. I really enjoyed working there and meeting other investors in the UK, and I, you know, they followed my blog, the Clear Eyes Investing blog, that I had after I left Motley Fool, and I really appreciate the interest, and I've learned a lot from UK investors that I probably would never have learned from before.
Okay.
Jim Slater, talk about Neil Woodford, of course,
yeah.
And Nick Train is a big influence of mine. Okay. So, you know, these are guys that I probably, if I'd stayed in the States throughout my career, probably wouldn't have come across, at least for a while. So, you know, learning from, institutional investors like those and retail investors, it's been a real pleasure.
No, that's great to know, mate. And thank you ever so much for coming on here. I really, really appreciate you doing that for us. And hopefully we'll be able to do some joint working in the future. We'll definitely keep in touch. All right, Todd.
All right.
Thank you ever so much, mate. And we'll speak again soon. Thank you ever so much for being on Conquest Corner. Todd, take care and God bless.
You too.
Bye.